Here's a short message from this show's sponsor, The Feed.
Yeah, so one of the things that we get asked by patients a lot is, what do you use for hydration? You know, and we've got a water cooler here in the corner, so water is first and foremost. But a lot of times it makes sense to add some electrolytes. And I kind of look at this in two different ways. One is, what do you drink through the day, right? Just at work or whatever. And then what do you do during exercise? For exercise, there's a lot of good options. You can measure sweat sodium composition and sweat rates and stuff. And we've talked about that. But for me, my standby go-to is scratch exercise hydration. I love the lemon lime, like old school, probably the first flavor Alan made. But that is my go-to for exercise. I'll try some others and use others in different situations, but scratch is what I always come back to. What about you?
I always keep a bag of scratch around. So in my cabinet right now, I have a large bag of the scratch lemon lime because I'm a creature of habit, but I've really enjoyed trying out some of the precision hydration stuff. The flavor is just the original flavor, and I don't know how to describe it, but it's nice. It's very inoffensive, and it's kind of a good way to mix it up. It's also got a bit more sodium, and I'm playing around with, maybe I want to have a few more carbs in my bottle, a bit more sodium in the bottle. And it's nice to kind of have those two options, and you can get both those products on the feed.
Yeah. Yeah. And then during the day, I'm a big fan of adding in something to the water as I drink through the day. Sometimes because it's necessary, a lot of times just to encourage drinking. And I'm more likely to continue to hydrate if it's got a little bit of a flavor to it. So what I will do typically is, in a fairly large bottle, I'll add a half a packet of Element. I like the orange flavor. Actually, I like a lot of the flavors, but for this little concoction, I like the orange. And then I'll do a half scoop of the Pillar magnesium drink, the pineapple one, which is not to everyone's taste. It's kind of a pina colada thing, but with the orange, it's just kind of a nice summery electrolyte mix.
Yeah, I'll go with the Element tabs when I'm traveling a lot, not the tabs, the sachets, because yeah, they're easy to travel with. It's something that I can toss in my bag when I'm in the airport. And maybe I'm a little skeptical about the flavor of the airport water, but I'll throw those in my big 40-ounce hydro flask. And then if I have them, I'll use whatever effervescent tablet, whether it's like a Noon, same thing from the Precision Hydration, and I'll toss that in. I just always try to make sure that with the day-to-day hydration, that I'm not getting the hydration fuel mixes yeah, that maybe you see with the Scratch and the Precision and some of these other ones. And I think there's always a great thing that they do on the website is they give you a breakdown of what that product's for oftentimes and kind of help you know, oh, this is for exercise, this is for day-to-day use, this is for wellness, whatever it might be. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind when you're shopping.
Yeah, I that's a great point. It's good to have the coaching and the information there too. Hi, everyone. This is The Podium, and I'm Dr. Kevin Sprouse. Our podcast originated as a resource for my practice where I work with professional athletes and high-performing individuals from around the world. Today, it has become a forum for an even greater audience, and we welcome everyone as we discuss the principles of performance and then disseminate pertinent, actionable info with our patients in mind. One thing to note before we begin, the content of this podcast is not meant as medical advice. This is for general informational purposes only. Welcome to The Podium.
Hello and welcome to our first pre-tour show of La Podium. I am Patrick Morris and I am joined here today by Dr. Kevin Sprouse.
Good morning, Patrick. Yeah, we're getting ready for Tour de France season. Everything is kind of coming to a crescendo for the race. And we're going to talk a bit about what goes on before the race and how do these teams prepare for an event like the Tour de France?
Yeah, preparation for this really starts, you could almost say, at the end of last season, correct?
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's when looking at which riders, especially if it's going to be their early in their career, like their first tour, oftentimes the team will set up the second half of the competition schedule the year before to lead in nicely to the first of this year and then the tour. So they may do the Vuelta to get that big block of, call it training, it's competition, but a 3-week race in, you know, August, September, so that they're coming into the off season with a big load ahead of a year that is going to be targeted for the tour. So it starts early.
Yeah. And it's been even different in the last few years because you've had to kind of look at it slightly differently, going from just the physiological prep and training prep, and then also kind of the strategic with the UCI points and the relegation and everything like that. So for everybody working within the team, there's a new wrench in the plan.
Yeah, it's, I mean, fortunately, that wasn't my role, but having that that threat of relegation put a lot of stress on the team. And I think the Netflix series is out now, and I actually haven't seen any of it yet. It came out 3 or 4 days ago. But I know that that's talked about in there, and that was a big impetus, I guess, that really pressured a lot of the decisions that were made in teams last year. And it continues. We're not really sure what form it will take. The UCI is notorious for, you know, being black and white with their rules, and then they change the next day. So you don't really know how it's going to play out in, you know, next time it becomes pertinent. But yeah, we're definitely taking it into account as we approach these races.
Yeah, I just had to get that in there to build a little bit more drama to kind of parallel with the Netflix series before we get into really the nuts and bolts of training and kind of how you all approach it, looking at different races as far as the pre-tour tune-up races, as well as pre-tour training camps, nutrition interventions, whatever it might be that you're doing ahead of the race.
Yeah, all of that stuff comes into play. So our head director is Charlie Bogelius, and he puts together the program for the guys, which is basically, you know, who's racing what races. And also what their roles are going to be at that race. And so you have guys who have raced the classics in the spring, some, you know, series of one day races, who maybe that's what they excel at, and they may help out at the tour, but they're typically not going to be the GC rider, the guy who's kind of tagged to try to win it. And then you've got guys who are specifically stage racers. Like they do better. They kind of, their physiology is such and their training is such that they perform better in 1 week races or longer. And I'll talk a bit about that with JV in a interview we'll drop in here in a minute. But there's even a bigger breakdown between like 1 week riders, and there's a lot of 1 week races on the calendar, 1 week to 10 days, versus somebody who does a grand tour, which is a 3 week race. And for those who aren't really familiar with cycling, there are three of those. There's the Tour of Italy, or the Giro d'Italia. There's the Tour de France, and then there's the Vuelta a España, which is the Tour of Spain. And they happen across basically May, July, and then August, September. The Vuelta crossing kind of August and September. So you've got different types of riders, and you want to bring them along differently throughout the course of the year, but also allow them to excel in those races where they might do best and get points for the team. So it's kind of a game of chess to get everybody to training camp where they need to be, having accomplished what they need to, and then preparing for this second push in the season, which is really highlighted by the Tour de France.
Yeah, I think that's something that's really helpful for, I mean, just a fan like myself to see, okay, there's all of these different riders. This guy was shining in the classics. Why isn't he at the tour? Or this rider looked really strong at the Giro. Why isn't he at the tour? Why aren't they riding all three tours, all three grand tours and that sort of a thing? And it's hard to tell, like, okay, early season, why haven't I seen Jonas winning races? Or why is Tade doing so well at the classics? It seems like he should wait longer, but that's all kind of part of the strategy.
It is. And, you know, it's something that has evolved through the years. I might be wrong in saying this, but it seems to me that Lance was kind of the first to really target the tour and just, I mean, sure, lots of people, the tour's always been big, but like to set up a schedule such that nothing else really matters except the Tour de France. You do the others to kind of train, and you'll win some of them if you're good, right? Just casually go win a race. But it was really all set up for the tour. And we have that for some riders now, but it's still a bit of a wider view where you've got the guys on a lot of teams who are targeting classics, who are targeting the Giro, which has a little bit of a different feel than the tour. And they kind of slot into places that work for them. You also can't realistically ask a rider to do all three grand tours. It's just too much of a load on the body. There are guys that have done it, and there are guys that have done it for years on end, but that's really the exception to the rule. So typically a grand tour rider or a stage racer is going to do one, maybe two grand tours out of the three in a year. And then they'll do some some 1 week races, maybe do the Ardennes classics, which are a little bit more particular or specific to these punchy riders like a Nielsen Palus, who can be a GC rider, but also kind of do those 1 day races. So it really depends on what physiology you're working with and what the team wants to accomplish. And it's, again, a game of chess that has to be set up to look at the whole season. But at the end of the day, the tour is what everyone wants to do best at.
Yeah, that's why it's always so fun to see riders that can excel at both as a fan of watching all of cycling, but realizing that most people are just going to tune in to the tour. So that's what they understand as cycling. So when you're looking at somebody like a Vanderpool or a Wout Van Aert, they don't understand like that it's shocking that they're doing so well on a mountain stage because they were also battling it out in a classic earlier in the year.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're right. I mean, most casual fans or non-fans really don't see much of cycling other than the tour. And, you know, for years when I've said, you know, I work in pro cycling, people just ask, oh, do you go to the Tour de France? Like, that's the one thing. And I know riders get asked this a lot, and some riders have a full and very successful career, never ride the Tour de France. And I remember the first, you know, it was probably 4 or 5 years of doing this before I got to go to the tour and having those conversations of, you know, yeah, I work for a World Tour team. Oh, what's the tour like? It's like, I don't know. I haven't been yet. So it is kind of the pinnacle, and the most experienced staff, the best riders, you know, that they all get kind of pushed to the tour. And the preparation for that is massively important. And we start that with, you know, the first part of that season ends. It doesn't end. There's no hard end, but like you get through the Ardennes classics, and then we start looking at the Tour de France. And for us, we started with a pre-tour altitude training camp in the French Pyrenees in May, and really used that to bring a bunch of the prospective tour riders to altitude and start to focus on this one event.
Yeah. And you had a chance to go to that camp and also interview a few of the riders and staff while you were there to kind of talk about what preparation looks like and what they're doing at that camp to kind of get ready for, or see who is ready for tackling the Tour de France.
Exactly. Yeah. So part of my role is setting up, not the day-to-day at the camps, but like the, some of the overarching themes and things that we're going to address from a sports science standpoint. And while I was there, I sat down with Nate Wilson, who is in charge of camps, and had a discussion a little bit about, this camp, why we have it and why we chose where we did.
All right. So we're here at the Tour de France camp. We are in Font-Remous at 1800 meters, and we've just kind of gotten started with a push toward the tour, you know, building fitness for these guys. With the tour in roughly, 6 weeks?
Yep.
Yeah. What are...
A bit more, seven, but yeah, seven. Six, seven.
As the primary architect of this camp, what are the primary goals for the guys?
The big goal is actually just like build a good foundation of fitness. So actually not so race specific, but put them in a good place where over the next, say, 3 to 4 weeks that really kick off in June leading into the tour and sort of last week of May, as we start inserting more specific work and more high intensity race type work, that they have the foundation of fitness that they're going to respond well to it. So we're kind of trying to like lay the stage so that they get the benefit from the work to come. So yeah, most of them have had a big spring of racing. So if anything, it's kind of trying to take a step back, take a bit of a break from intensity, focus more on the aerobic system, get good endurance, almost get a little bit fresh in terms of removing some of that intensity stimulus, but kind of build a different kind of fitness.
Yeah. And camp gives a good opportunity for some oversight, not in a heavy-handed way, but to make sure that there's a tendency to maybe push too hard right now. Like you said, coming off of a hard spring, you actually had this talk with the guys yesterday that it requires a bit of a dialing it back before you can go hard again. And camp gives us a chance to pull the reins a little bit, oversee that, control nutrition a bit. And I don't mean control like weigh their food. You know, we take a little bit it's not so heavy-handed, but kind of make sure they're getting good food. There's a chef here. Really, like you said, set the stage for moving forward. How long is camp?
This camp's going to be 17 days.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, I think like you said, it is a really good opportunity to like have a little bit more of a supported environment. Like a lot of times when the guys come to camp, they can also train harder, but at like lower fatigue than they might have for the same training load at home, because they're not cooking, they're getting good food, like that's coordinated with the training plan. They've got support from the follow car. They've got like peers to train with. So the mental barrier to entry is a bit lower.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it lets us, yeah, get good work done without too much risk.
So we got a lot of good takeaways there from Nate that I think maybe show that camp is a bit different than what we would think looking at, oh, they're prepping for the Tour de France. They're not just out there smashing each other every day. It's a lot more about building freshness, having that foundation, sprinkling in some intensity, but also the support on the outside of it that you kind of help put together, coordinating with the nutrition team, the recovery and that sort of a thing, and the importance of that for those 2 weeks.
Yeah, it really does set the stage for moving into this push toward the Tour. And Nate is fantastic at doing this. We had him on another podcast, a full podcast, I think about a year ago. And he's a fantastic resource for these riders and great for our team. We actually sat down to have that conversation at camp. We had kind of a, I don't know what you'd call it, a group room or a community room where we had an altitude tent set up and we had some weights and just kind of had, there was food for the riders, just kind of a place for them to assemble. And we thought we were going to sit down and have a pretty deep conversation on this stuff. And then riders started to come up and we grabbed a few of them and conscripted them into the conversation as well. But it was fun. But yeah, that little snippet got cut a little bit short, which I only mentioned because that's how camp goes. A lot of it is very structured, and then there's time that's very unstructured. And during that time, the staff that's there, we're really just there to take care of the riders and whatever comes up. I did get to have a bit longer conversation on some of these same topics with Jonathan Bodders. And Jonathan, or JV as we call him, is the founder of the team. He was a, for those who don't know, he was a pro cyclist on the U.S. Postal Service team with Crédit Agricole, a French team, has been around the sport for quite a while. And he and I sat down and kind of talked through some of these things as well about altitude and when and where we do camps.
Yeah, let's hear from JV.
So yeah, JV, thanks for joining. I've got a couple questions for you about preparation for the Tour de France. We just came off of an altitude camp where most of the Tour team was there. I was there for the first part of it. And there's a lot of thought that goes into that, which sounds maybe obvious, but I think even at that point, most people, casual observers, don't understand just how much we kind of ruminate over things like altitude. You know, is 1800 meters enough, 2000, 2400, like where does it need to be? Broad strokes though, when you're looking at a pre-Tour de France camp for riders or a preparation event like this, what are some of the main objectives and the most important things that you are looking to get out of that for riders?
Well, I mean, it depends sort of what phase it is in the preparation for the race, but you know, in this particular case, at this camp, the May camp, you know, there's a very careful balance of a lot of things going on there. You know, on one side of the equation, you had, you know, Nielsen Palace, who had an incredible early season, raced quite late into the early season, all the way to Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and was just starting his training again as he came into the camp. Like the camp was literally, you know, some of his first bike rides after taking a break after Liège-Bastogne-Liège. Conversely, on the other side of that, you had Richard Carapaz, who didn't have a good early season, who stopped his early season fairly early, you know, to recover from some illness. He was coming into the camp in a real, like, I need to build a foundation. So, you know, the objectives are quite diverse. And then to add another level of complexity there, you know, we have people who are going to have very different responses to the actual altitude itself, meaning, you know, Nielsen grew up at sea level. has lived much of his life in either Sacramento or Florida, lives in Nice on the sea right now. So his reaction to, you know, 1800 meters in altitude was already probably enough to like get a stimulus going of some sort, right? Whereas Carapaz lives at 3000 meters, grew up at 3000 meters, and often trains all the way up to 4000 meters. I don't know. Do I need to put that into American terms?
No, I think yeah, multiply by three, roughly.
Yeah, multiply by three, exactly. 3.3. But anyway, yeah. So, and so, you know, for Carapaz, it's like basically he's going down to go to an altitude camp and he needs to train really hard. For Nielsen, he's going up and, you know, is just starting his training again. So crafting the training program for the team is pretty tricky. And I mean, we made a lot of adjustments, which was pretty interesting of how we did that, meaning that like, you know, Carapaz was in an altitude tent, you know, what were you guys putting him at, like 3,800, 3,500?
Well, we had one, we would have him sleep at, yeah, about 3,800, 3,500 to 3,800, yeah. Right. Which was, you know, 2,000 meters added by the tent to where we were natively. And then occasionally, I think he spent some time a little higher than that, like after a ride. Yeah, afternoon time. So getting that exposure. But you're right. Even the company that made the altitude tents, when we went to them and said, okay, we're setting up a tent, an altitude tent at altitude, their head kind of exploded. They didn't know how to compute you know, how much altitude we should prescribe in the tent and all. It was very much like you said, kind of not pushing boundaries, but thinking a little bit outside of the typical box, because you have to individualize it to the group that you have there.
Well, and you know, with Richard, the training rides were mainly done at like 1,000 meters or lower because we were actually going down most of the time into the valley. So for him, for instance, his training, I mean, he basically never trains that low in Ecuador. And so in order to, you know, keep him stimulated, we almost had to crank up the altitude tent to that. And a lot of people don't realize this, but I'm a big, you know, because I was an altitude native myself, meaning I grew up in Colorado. I was born in Colorado. People don't realize that with people who are born and raised and live most of their lives at high altitude, that it, you know, when they come down, you know, they have just like anyone else, like sort of a month where things work really well, or maybe even 6 weeks where everything's working really well, at sea level. But you get to a point where you're so saturated with oxygen that your body literally, you know, is basically shutting off all the mechanisms to produce new red blood cells. And interestingly, what I found was it not only did my performance radically drop off, as you could see the red cells were coming down and my ability to, you know, to buffer acid was coming down, all of that would drop off. But actually not having that hypoxic stimuli somehow almost led to what I would best describe as like a little bit of a depression. So it was like you had like an anemia and a depression going on at like 10 weeks after leaving altitude. And you see it with the Colombians and the Ecuadorians all the time. If you leave them at sea level too long, that like they get depressed, they get homesick, they don't perform well anymore. So with Carapaz bringing him over mid-May, which is a long way off from the Tour de France, we had to adjust for that, because I think if we would have just like sort of let him live at his house in Monaco at sea level all the way to the Tour de France, he would have a horrible Tour de France.
Yeah. That's a really interesting point. And you know, I'll have to take your word on the depression part, but it kind of makes sense, you know, having experienced it.
It's anecdotal. I can't say why that was, but it definitely, and I've talked to Colombians about it too. It's just, you feel really lethargic, you know, like it's just like, you feel sort of like lighter when you're up at high altitude as somebody who grew up at altitude.
Well, I think people can, recognize this in other ways, like when you're under any kind of stress, good stress, but like you're working at something and that's taken away, a lot of times there's that that depression afterwards. It's like, because everything's going easily. So in this case, you've got this physiologic challenge that's just always there at baseline that's taken away. There's a bit of a drive that's gone. And then you throw in the fact that you're away from family and in a different a different environment. It's just, yeah, I can absolutely see how that would happen.
So then, I mean, to add on top of that, at the camp, you have, you know, some riders that as they're coming up to high altitude, they need to fuel. They're already at race weight. They need to fuel extra because there's an extra metabolic load due to the fact that they're at altitude. So they're burning more sugar. So you know, you definitely need to make sure that they don't catabolize themselves. Conversely, you know, in like Richard's case, he was actually still trying to like lose weight. So, you know, for the nutritionist, for the, you know, for the chef that we have at the camp, that's also a pretty big challenge in that you're trying to design very different dietary plans. And it can't, you know, I mean, it's like, it's always good when you have sort of a unifying team camp where everyone comes together and bonds and goes out and does the work together. But you know, with the pre-Tour de France altitude camps, it becomes very specialized where the guys, yes, they do spend time together. Yes, they do ride their bikes some together, but then there's a lot of individualization, which obviously is a big workload for everyone on the staff because you're not pursuing a training program and a dietary schedule. You're pursuing 8 different training programs and 8 different dietary schedules and 8 different altitude tent schedules.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think it is a big workload, but I think the staff that we have in particular that we have in place right now really likes that challenge and likes the cerebral part of it because they understand that individualization and they feel right. Like all that work is making a difference. So it's kind of fun too. It's a little harder to get a bunch of people who are academically inclined together and tell them, hey, this is the rote thing that we're doing for everyone.
Right.
So there's, I think there's good there too for the
staff. Yeah, no, for sure. But yeah, so anyway, that's how the best I would describe our camps. And then we've got, you know, the one that will be after the Dauphiné pre-Tour de France. And that one will be even trickier because we're trying to do it at 2,400 meters, probably not as much exposure to the tent to make sure everyone's sleeping really well to recover for the Tour de France. But crucially, we will have to make sure everyone is heat adapted because, you know, the whole Tour de France, I mean, you never know. I mean, the Tour de France can obviously at any point can get really hot, but, if you spend time at altitude, and this is one of the classic mistakes of altitude camps is people go up to altitude, they get a great adaptation to the altitudes, you know, red cell count comes up, you know, their ability to their bicarbonate level comes up, you know, they're going great. And they forget about heat adaptation. Then they come down to their race at sea level and it's 80% humidity and, you know, it's 100 degrees. And the altitude is just right out the window because after 3 hours of racing, you're just overheated. No matter how much water you try to pour down your throat, it's not going to help because your digestive tract actually can't handle that much liquid because you haven't trained it to. And you know, you're just not sweating at the rate you need to keep yourself cool. You totally overheat, you blow up, and your altitude training was completely useless. So we have to make sure that, you know, especially in the last 2 weeks, 3 weeks before the Tour de France, that we're balancing heat adaptation with the altitude, which don't normally go together because it's not hot at 2,400 meters.
Right. Which is, you know, we've got a good program in place that even starts months ago to make sure that's in place, but that stimulus is in place for the riders. But you're right. It's easy to overlook a lot of times, especially in endurance sport, there's a focus on red cells or, you know, some of the things that are very specific to oxygen carrying capacity. But if you can't handle the heat, then all that goes out the window.
Yeah.
You gotta step back and take a much broader view.
So lots of great takeaways there from JV about how individualized and specific team camp has to be for each athlete. You know, you think everybody's prepping for the same race. It's like, oh, we're all going to go ride the race. We need to do these mountain efforts because we're going to have to climb through the Alps. But it's really not like that at all.
No, it's not. I mean, everybody comes to that that camp and the push for the race from a different place. And I mean, even if you've got two riders that should have had a similar build, like similar program, et cetera, oftentimes there's injuries or illness that, you know, kind of derails one and they may have a very different lead into that camp. And so they're working on something totally different. And so when we get there, it's very much a balance of applying a stimulus that will be beneficial for the individual, but not push them over, right? Not over fatigue them or put them in a place that is going to be hard to recover from. And that looks different for every person that comes up there.
Yeah, I found it especially interesting, the discussion around athletes coming down from elevation to go to an elevation camp or just going to the tour or going to races. That's not something that I had really considered about the like month out after you've come down from living in, whether it's Colombia or Ecuador or in Colorado or whatever it may be, the change that has, because you always just think, oh, you're going to be able to ride faster. You're not at elevation. Things will be better.
Yeah. And they are for a while. But it's an interesting challenge. There's a lot of research about, you know, taking sea level dwellers to altitude and what that training looks like and how to optimize it and get them to a race, you know, when to bring them down, all that stuff. But there's not nearly as much about native altitude dwellers. So somebody like Carapaz, who is born and lives at 3,000 meters. So that's, you know, that's, gosh, almost 13,000 feet. That's really high. That's considerably higher than Leadville, right? Which is the highest town we have here in the US. And so figuring out how to manage that and not lose that adaptation and subsequently form from that is a bit tricky, but yeah, I think we managed it well. We'll see.
Yeah. It's also interesting to hear about how much you're using, you know, we're in a world where, you know, we mentioned altitude tents in there and there's a lot of technology to it, but so much of that discussion was around using environmental stimuli, you know, whether it's altitude or heat to generate the training. And I think that's an interesting takeaway for those of us listening that maybe you're like, okay, how can I make my own training camp or whatever it might be? It doesn't have to be, you know, altitude tents and all this, that, and the other thing. It can be, oh, I'm going to go a little higher or I'm going to go a little hotter.
Yeah, no, that's entirely true. It's, I'd say even for us, you know, 80 to 90% of what benefit we get from these things doesn't require expensive tools and gadgets. But when you're going for the Tour de France, you want every 1% that you can get. And so in that regard, it's for us, it's well worth the time, the money, the energy that is spent on these tools. But it doesn't mean that it is for everyone. So that's a really good point. One of the things we didn't talk about there with JV is the fact that strength training plays a big role. And I mentioned that in the kind of the community area we had set up for the riders, we had brought some weights. And so the hotel had a little gym, but it was your typical hotel gym. So Nate and one of our staff members, Paul Navin, he's been with the team pretty much as long as I have. He has been a soigneur for years, is excellent at that role, but has a background in as a physio. And he's an Irish guy, which you'll hear in a minute. But Paul Navin is, he's got years working with us as a soigneur, and this year has taken over in a performance role, kind of working on a lot of the specifics with riders and making sure that from a strength and conditioning standpoint, they are kind of on point with what they need to do, among many other things that we'll talk about. But in that role, you know, he helped make sure that we had everything in this room that we needed for team camp. And we talked a little bit about why that's important and how that's changed across the decade or more that he and I have both been in the sport.
Yeah, I'm always happy to hear other people talk about the value of strength training for endurance athletes. Let's hear from Paul.
I think another thing that we've done really well over the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years is the implementation of strength and conditioning with the guys. And you've played a big role in that with your background as a physio. I'd be curious just to hear your thoughts on how that has changed from when you and I first started in the sport, you know, 10, 12 years ago to now. I see it as almost night and day difference, but I'm curious your thoughts.
I completely agree. I mean, when I started, like, I was really, really taken aback when I started. And like, there was maybe, I would say, two guys out of the 30 on the team who might be doing a bit of gym work in the off season, but that'd be it. And it was like what I would say initially, a lot of the challenge in getting guys to work on their bodies was almost like selling the message rather than what, like, it's not like you could have had the best program to give them, but it was almost like the work had to be put into like trying to educate riders into why, if they work on their bodies and are kind of more well-rounded athletes, that they're going to respond better. Like, they're going to respond better to various challenges they face day to day on the bike, or if they crash, they might recover better, or if they get knee pain every spring, that there are things we can do in the off season to try and mitigate against it as well. So there's been like that whole culture has changed hugely, like where I would say pretty much everybody has an off bike routine now. We have our own S&C coach who's excellent. And he's called Ian Piper, and he works with the EIS. And I think what we have found as well is that a rider's body is just completely different to a track and field body or a field sports body, as you know as well yourself. And a lot of the time we would find riders would have programs that are like just way too ambitious and to the point of being a bit dangerous, in that just due to the position they're in for such a long part of the day, that they just don't have the spinal mechanics maybe or hip mechanics to be able to squat really well or do a deadlift or things like that. So like a lot of Ian's message has just been trying to keep things very simple but very structured and pointed as well, that it really hits what the rider needs to hit and is kind of planned in the proper way, but it's not going to unduly stress parts of their body that we don't want stress put on, or it's going to cause a back injury or things like that.
Yeah. It's that pendulum swing where at one point they did nothing and then they realized it was important, and you have people doing too much or too aggressive, inappropriately aggressive programs, and now bringing it back to what's meaningful and effective. And
yeah. Yeah. And like I've been lucky enough to live in Girona as well for the past 10 years. And I'd often be in the gym and kind of incognito, and obviously seeing a lot of different riders in the gym, and God, you see them trying to do things that just with such poor technique, like they just can't, like they physically can't bend their spine that way, like what they're meant to do, or like for a deadlift. Or so it's just about being very specific in what you do and getting the benefits of what you want to do, but without adding to their injury risk. There's so much of what we try to implement are things that have come and gone over the years that you look at the evidence for it, and it can be kind of flimsy. But when you look at the evidence behind like riders being strong in terms of strong and robust, how it can add to their peak power, it doesn't add to an increase of weight, improves performance. And there are some good studies now that actually back that up pretty well, even in pro cycling. So it's like, I think it's been neglected for too long, and we're only starting to catch up a bit, and it's still early days, but I think it's really important, as well as not so much even the heavy lifting stuff, but just in educating riders around their bodies, that it's not so much of like there used to be a huge, like there generally used to be a big thing of like a rider crashes, their pelvis went out of place, they needed to see somebody to get their pelvis back into place, and now they're okay. Whereas if you can educate them that it's like, you've crashed, you're tight here and there, you need some treatment, this is what you can do, you're going to be fine, you're a really resilient athlete, you're one of the top in the world, this is how you can get better. Right, like it kind of empowers them a lot more. I hope at least that they're more confident in themselves and can see ways where they can help themselves.
Yeah, I think you're 100% correct on that. It's one of those things where if you've not built that strength and physical resilience, but also just kind of a, you learn your body differently when you're training it in a strength and conditioning manner, as opposed to just sitting on a bike. And you start to learn what you can do and can't do, and what benefits you get from doing these things. So it's a modality, I think, that benefits riders in both obvious ways and not so obvious ways. And I remember one of the first camps I went to, like a December, you know, off-season camp in Calpe. You may have been there. And I remember having the riders all in a room, and maybe I had brought bands, but somebody had bands to put around, you know, ankles and knees into these lateral walks. And we were in a conference room, and we were just doing like activation stuff before the ride. And I remember putting on, you know, a band around my ankles and showing them what to do, basically to walk down the conference room and back. And I mean, these are the guys who presumably have some of the strongest legs in the world, right? World tour cyclists. And many of them were making it half, you know, I'd gone down and back, right? As a 35-year-old doctor, not one of the greatest athletes in the world, gone down and back to demonstrate this. I think Rabin had done it, our chiropractor, who's awesome, and just showing him what was done, and gave the guys this thing. They start, and about half of them stop halfway down the room. They're like, ah, this is killing me. My glutes are just dying. And it was the first time that this hit me, that like, these guys, like, there's a lot of low hanging fruit here from a strength and conditioning standpoint. But you're right, we've come a long way. And I mean, yeah, the guys on the team now, that would have no problem with that. I mean, that not only would we not have to introduce it, they would just like fly through it and on to the next. So it's doesn't mean they're better athletes. Doesn't mean, you know, it's just a foundational component of their fitness that is there, that wasn't there previously. And I've heard, I mean, TJ Van Garderen is very vocal about the fact that he wishes he had done more of this stuff during his career, because he feels like it was a real hole in his training that led to, you know, he would have been more resilient and all sorts of things. So it's just times change, but in a good way.
Lots of great takeaways there from Paul about strength training, as well as the wonderful story. I think you had a video of that band walk experience that you shared with me. So I got to see this, and that was just a somewhat comical to see these guys that you see on TV and you're just like, how are they doing? I mean, they're, you know, 400 or 500 watts, whatever it might be. But then the simple little activation exercises just are such a struggle. But hearing that you can kind of work that into the system, have a little more control over it at camp, and then see the guys really start to flourish in some of those movements has got to be huge for them.
It is. And it's really been something that has come along, gosh, in the last 6, 8, 10 years. And I think really led to a lot of resilience in riders, which, again, I kind of mentioned in there, it doesn't make them better athletes, but it makes them better suited to get the most out of their athletic ability. And that's really what we're going for here. And Paul is so good at helping these guys with that and just being very pragmatic about what they should be doing, what they shouldn't be doing, how to do it, making sure they have good form. I mean, if you can't tell, I'm thrilled he's in this role this year with the team. And for years to come, hopefully, he's a great asset.
Yeah, hearing from all these different clips, it sounds like camp really, you know, we might look at, oh, they're going to a Tour de France camp. They're really trying to gain a whole lot of fitness, or they're trying to really do this big build. But it seems like a lot more of it is about, okay, how do we make sure that they're getting the most of their like absolute potential that they have? Because these guys have been riding bikes for so long that the fitness is kind of there. And they're just like, how do we make sure that everything is firing, they're healthy, uninjured, not sick, at a weight that they want to be at, the nutrition's in line, and everything as perfectly as you can in a period before the tour.
Yeah. It's like Nate Wilson said in earlier in the clip we had, where, you know, this is really about getting some training volume, like, but nothing that crazy. A lot of them, like you said, they've been training for years. They've got huge training load under their belt, and it's halfway through the season. So they should be pretty much at a spot where they can, you know, take a little time off and then start to rebuild. They're not all in that same spot, but that's kind of the idea, that this is going to be a training build. We let the altitude stimulus do its thing, and then we focus on a lot of the other things, like like strength and conditioning that's so important, like nutrition that's so important. And we had Will Gerling is our chief nutritionist. And he came to camp, was with the guys for the majority of the camp, is now at the Dauphiné or Swiss. I think he's doing both. He's kind of, in other words, he's omnipresent. He's helping these guys with all the nutritional aspects on the bike, off the bike, recovery, all that stuff. And he sat down and gave us a little breakdown on what it is that he does with the guys at a camp like this ahead of a big race like the Tour de France.
Yeah, let's hear from Will.
Considering the nutrition preparation for the Tour de France, really looks at going over the stages, going over what the whole of the Tour de France looks like, and then implementing preparation and training for specifics that we might be doing at the Tour, and plans and implementation of maybe additional supplements and gut training, and then covering the foundations. So foundations is all about making sure that those riders are arriving at Tour de France in the best condition possible. And this is making sure, obviously, their body composition is correct, that they are achieving the right body composition for them for this race. And most likely, this is going to be the leanest body composition that they can achieve while still staying healthy and still maintaining power output and recovery between sessions and days. Depending on the rider, will depend on how much they need to lose and the period of time of which this happens over. We obviously did a training camp in May where we had a lot of the potential Tour de France riders at that camp, and we worked out a plan for them in terms of where they are in their body composition and where they need to be at the time of the Tour and how to get there. And with this, I create templates and implement nutritional amounts in terms of macros of carbohydrate, protein, and fat, and then give them guidance on when and what to have and use those templates in relation to their training and what that looks like also through their day in terms of timing and how it's divided through the day. Other foundations is just making sure that they're doing regular gut training, which is ensuring that they're able, their stomach is able to manage 90 grams an hour or definitely up to 120 grams an hour so they can perform and also recover from that perspective. And this is just done with 1 to 2 sessions a week, ensuring that they're just taking that volume of food on board and able to deal with it, especially with some intensity. So any ride that's lasting 4 hours or longer and has efforts is the kind of sessions that we're looking at, because one, we have the calories to be able to deal with that and actually have that higher level of food intake and still have a normal day of eating afterwards. But also because that we need to have the hour on hour consumption so they can get used to taking it. Whereas if they only did 2 hours, it's very easy to have 2 hours of 90 grams an hour and not feel any issues, because there's not the potential for it to get harder as it progresses. And we know that there is an increase in GI distress the longer exercise continues. And then we also need intensity in it, because as exercise intensity increases, it decreases blood flow to the stomach and can increase the chance of then GI distress again. So they need to be able to manage taking on high amounts of carbohydrate whilst doing high intensity exercise. So we've done the foundations. Now, when we look at the overall Tour and the stages that there are other things that we want to implement. So maybe a new product has come out, like Morton Bicarb, where we're curious and interested to see how that works day on day. Is there significant amounts of water weight gain? Does it happen exponentially if they take it day on day? And how do they interact with that product? And how do they perform? And what are the feelings from it? And it's also to make sure that every rider uses it, because if we did decide to use it, then nobody's been left out. And they actually have a concrete understanding and an idea of how it feels and what it tastes like and so on. That's one part. Another one might be looking at low fiber, stages where we might want to do low fiber. And at the camp, we had a great opportunity to do a full menu run through where we essentially took a 5-day period where we implemented multiple different things that we're going to enact at the Tour de France, like a low fiber diet, like Morton bicarb, and implemented them into this camp scenario and let them actually feel and go through a full run through and got feedback and also saw how they reacted both from a power and body composition perspective. Preparation would also entail me working with Peter Shep, who's the head of performance, going through calorie expenditures for all of the riders, working out how much they're going to burn and how much they're going to expend for each stage, and then pre-planning a lot of the food for the riders so they know what to have and how much to have each stage. Now, this is something that's more of an opt-in for us at this team because that's the kind of culture that we have. And it's a culture that's very free, very open, and we allow the riders to make those choices and support them in the best way possible. So there are many riders who will be tracking their food. Majority of the riders at Tour France will be tracking their food. And then some of those, I will be planning their food for them and then tweaking and adjusting it as each stage is done. So some will just track it with my guidelines, and then some will want it pre-planned, and then some won't track anything and just go from feeling and historical understanding of their bodies and how to fuel for the effort that they're giving each day. I think another big part of this preparation for the Tour de France is from more of a logistical perspective, looking at how we're managing heat, a lot of on-bike cooling that we've implemented this year, including how we're using electric coolers in the cars with ice gels and making cold feeds. And these things are more, as mentioned, logistical. So the staff will be implementing them, the soigneurs, and me with the DS to choose what feeds are cold feeds. This way the riders can actually perform their best also at the camp. And this isn't something you just turn up and do. It is something that we've had to implement protocols, buy equipment for, and make sure that we actually have the ability to do that and deliver it at the best possible way at the Tour de France.
So lots of great takeaways there from Will. I think it's interesting to hear how you're approaching kind of the like sports science side of it, looking at the hydration, the fueling strategies, the on-bike stuff, but then you're also taking advantage of just the general good nutrition foundations, having the chef there, prepping the meals for them, having everything lined up to where the riders don't really have to think about it for 2 weeks, which has got to save them a lot of hassle. And then also it just makes it to where you kind of get to support their training optimally.
Yeah. And you say not have to think about it while they're there, which is totally the goal. We even try to make it so that you on the bike and immediately after the bike, it's all protocol. They know what works for them. They know how much they're going for in terms of volume, or I guess mass of carbohydrates per hour. So it's really about just setting them up to a place that they're comfortable in their nutritional performance. And Will does a great job with that. I sat down with Paul again, Paul Navin, and talked just about some more specifics around pre-camp and some of the things we try to, that we really try to dial in and accomplish at these camps. So to kind of wrap up that pre-tour idea or pre-tour camp idea, I just want to kind of play one more clip with him because I think he's so good at laying this out there.
Yeah. Happy to hear from Paul again.
So with your new role on the performance staff or more solidly, you've straddled the soigneur role and a bit of the performance role, physio, for a few years now, and we've pulled you over to the performance side, and thrilled to have you working on more projects with us. I'm curious, describe a bit about the pre-tour camp that you're at now, kind of some of the goals we have and how we hope this rolls into the tour and affects the riders throughout the course of the race.
Yeah, like I guess that's twice I've had some serendipity in that I was lucky enough to be able to join the performance group, and I'm learning so much from you guys and everything that's going on in that space, that it's amazing how little awareness you have of what's going on behind the scenes, really. Even like, even though you might spend whatever 150 days working for the team or 200 days, like to have an awareness of what's going on behind the scenes so that everything arrives at the optimal position is just is amazing. So we're here now, or generally what we would do is run a May camp at altitude to prepare almost obviously for the tour, but like generally the riders will be also preparing for either Swiss or Dauphiné, which are the two main races prior to the tour. And then obviously the tour itself. So generally what we're trying to do is give them a space where they can train really well. They're really well supported when they train. They've got nutrition. They've got a chef, which has kind of been a key addition this year. They have got altitude, obviously, physio, massage, medical input, and then all types of different things that we're trying to develop behind the scenes as well, as pretty much you're heading up yourself, almost to prepare the rider to arrive at the tour at their absolute limit or at absolute peak, maybe, or just short of their peak so that they can peak at the tour. And then also, which I think is key, which we've really tightened up on in the last few years, is that we're not trying new things at important races. And the camp kind of gives us a chance where we can trial things. And as you know, like each rider is different and you can look at different studies to say, oh, this will help with this and has benefits in various areas. But until the rider actually tries it for themselves and feels for themselves that it is a benefit, then it doesn't really carry over, because it can be as promising as anything on a paper, but until they actually trial it themselves, feel the benefit and get the buy-in then of the rider, that's kind of a key component to it as well. They also have a mechanic here so that the bikes are seen every day. They've got a car following. They've also got gym equipment so that they can continue to work on their off-bike program. We're trying different things around heat and cooling. It's like we spoke about earlier. It's just this whole thing of like the momentum behind trying to prepare riders better and trying different things to see how those things work.
Yeah. Yeah. And part of trying that is as staff members seeing if it would make sense or if it's applicable on the road, because even a hotel at altitude, maybe it may well be in a far flung space like Font-Romeu where you're a bit rural, but you're still coming back to the same place every time. On the tour, it's even harder because it's day to day. You're somewhere different, and so if we trial some of these things around cooling or whatever it is, nutrition, and we can't make it work at the camp for riders logistically, then we know that even though it may have scientific, you know, sound basis, it's not something we can use at the tour, right? Because it's got to work logistically as well as scientifically. So it provides a good, I don't know, playground for us to try things out, in addition to seeing how the riders tolerate different things.
Yeah, I mean, that's crucial, because even, I mean, if we bring it right down to such a simple resource as ice, like the demands now at the tour is that we would on every single day have a minimum of 50 kilos of good ice available. And in the past, like, it looks like we found a solution for that now, but in the past we'd have been reliant on hotels, like every hotel we visit providing us with 50 kilos of good ice. And you might be sharing with two other teams who've also requested 50 kilos of ice, and the hotel is like, well, I mean, it's just not possible. Or they've maybe taken a shortcut and gone down to the fish market and gotten 50 kilos of ice, but it stinks of fish and you can't use that. And it just kind of adds to the general stress of the logistics of a day. But like, if you just use that as one example of one part of what we're doing, it's like there are huge things like hotels, and then even things around like air conditioning in hotels. And you could have, I don't know, like we could be staying, as you know, in a hotel on the third week before a key stage in 35 degrees heat and no aircon. And your direct opponent could be staying in a 5-star luxury chateau a kilometer down the road with like aircon and all the mod cons. But it's like, it comes down to things like that as well. And it's amazing that it does at this level, but it's trying to kind of find the workaround that when that does arise, that the rider's performance and recovery isn't going to be impacted too much.
Yeah. And I think most people don't realize that situation plays out probably every night at the tour, because the tour organizer assigns hotels and teams cannot get their own hotels. So in a given location, there may be, like you said, a 5-star chateau with a Michelin-starred restaurant, and then a bunch of little roadside motels that are some of them quite poor. And they try to rotate and say, you know, if you had the chateau at the last village, then you get the crappy hotel next time. So it's a bit luck of the draw. There might be some politics in there. I'm not going to get into all that, but I think there's been plenty of scenarios where you look at it and you kind of scratch your head and like, really? This is how it played out today? But so we have to just work within that situation that we're given. And those are the things we're trying to kind of mitigate with some of the strategies that we may test at a pre-tour race.
Yeah, exactly. To me, it's a huge, it's a roll of the dice. Yeah. I've seen it so many times. And I'm just, because you can barely sleep yourself. Like, and you're obviously working, but it's like you wake up some mornings, haven't slept maybe 4 hours, and, you're like, wow, I know the guys were feeling equally as hot last night. And how must they be feeling this morning? I think in the last few years as well, like it's something we've really improved on as well. And in fairness to the ESO, they do provide aircon units now for hotels that don't have air conditioning that we can install in the rooms. But again, it's kind of roll of the dice stuff, which we want to try and mitigate against.
So Paul did a great job of laying out all the important things that we try to test ahead of the Tour de France and the reasons why it needs testing. Our resources are really limited. Even though the Tour de France is the pinnacle of the sport, we're not just flush with cash. It's not the Premier League. It's not Major League Baseball. So there's limitations there, but there's more importantly, there's limitations in terms of staff, number of staff that you can have at the tour, because hotel rooms are limited. And they're limited by the ASO. I mean, they're limited geographically because there's only so many hotel rooms in certain places, but the ASO only gives you so many hotel rooms and tells you which hotels you're going to be in. And so the accoutrement in the hotel, what you have access to, is severely limited too. So if you come into the race thinking you're going to do all these sports science things, you realize very quickly that you're handcuffed by the resources at hand. And so in order to make sure that we come to the race with a regimen that's totally buttoned up, with a level of comfort around doing these things, we test them at the pre-tour training camp. And so just prior to recording this, Paul and I had spent some hours, I believe, putting together altitude tents, 8 sleep mattress coolers, some of the things that we want to use at other camps coming up, and then at the Tour de France. We won't use the altitude tents at the tour, but being able to figure out how to do these things in an efficient manner, like set them up and utilize them, it's a really difficult part of it.
Yeah, I think Paul brings an interesting perspective, having been a soigneur for so long and being the one that's transporting the luggage around, getting the room set up, doing the massages, trying to set up now mattress pads, trying to set up air conditioning units that may be supplied by the ASO for a different hotel or whatever it might be. My favorite aside that he provided us with there was the ice and the trying to figure out how to get the ice, and then just this really negative experience that built up in my head of getting an ice sock on a hot stage and it being from a fish market, because that's all that you could get. And then you and your compadres just smell like a fish market.
Yeah. Oh, it's true. And that has happened. That's why he knows about it. And even worse, it's in the cooler. So you could go to get a bottle out of the cooler when you're warming up, whatever, and you open it and it smells like fish. So, yeah, you have to be really careful about these things. And it's hard to come by ice in Europe. I mean, I think in the US, we definitely take it for granted. You can go down to the corner store and leave with just kilos and kilos and kilos of ice, like whatever you want. In Europe, that's not easy at all to come by. So hopefully some of those conversations gave you a little idea of what goes into a pre-tour camp and some of the preparation for riders and staff. You know, what we have to foresee and kind of prepare for in a race where we really don't know what's going to happen. You know, even though it may be somebody's 5th, 10th, 15th Tour de France, they're all unique in their challenges. So, yeah, maybe that gave you a little glimpse into how we address it.
Yeah, so we've talked a lot about addressing the pre-tour camp. Now, I'd really like to know what goes into picking who goes to that camp, and then really what makes a good GC rider, and then how you pick the team.
Yeah. So that comes down to, I guess there's two stages of that. One is hiring the riders, right? So, there's that first barrier is getting them on the team. And it's easy to look at the top 1, 2, 3 guys and know, yeah, they're going to do great. Right. I mean, you can look at the past 4 or 5 Tours de France, look at who won or who podiumed. And right there, you've got a list of people you'd probably love to have on your team. But that's a limited list, and it's a resource intensive list. It costs a lot of money to get those guys. And so there are other things that we have to look at as well in kind of putting together a team, both in the hiring part of it, which I don't really play a role in. And then in the assembly of that team, which falls to Charlie Wagelius usually. And he will look at, you know, the performance over the course of the year so far and the type of course it is and everything, and try to match a team up to it. But we usually start with a long list. The Tour de France team will be 8 riders. Start with a long list that may have, I don't know, 14, 15, and then goes to a short list, which is probably 10 or 11. And typically at the camps, you're going to have the short list, maybe a couple other riders. And then the decision is made for the team really just ahead of the race. Like, and our team's pretty notorious for doing it very late. So, you know, in the week before the Tour de France, they'll finalize who's going to be on the team. But I had a couple conversations, with some folks about what makes a good GC rider, GC, general classification. I had to think about that one for a minute. It's been so long that I just say GC. So that's the guy who's trying to win the race, right? Or get the highest placing. And what predisposes to that. And at a foundational level, I talked to Aaron Bagish, Dr. Aaron Bagish, who's been on the podcast before, sports cardiologist, sports physiologist, who has, moved from, Mass General Hospital to, Lausanne, Switzerland, and is now working there in a similar type capacity with athletes and hand in hand with the IOC. And we had a good talk about what cardiac metrics might predispose someone to be a good Tour de France rider.
Are there any cardiac metrics that predispose someone to success in an event like the Tour de France? Maybe not genetically or congenitally, but if you were to screen a population of athletes who are at the peak, right, who might be moving toward an event like this, what would you see in those that are likely to be successful, recognizing that there's a lot that goes into success? Yeah. So the easy place to start with this is to compare elite level athletes to recreational athletes or even sedentary people. And there, the differences are quite striking. First one we've already talked about a little bit, and that's heart size. So heart size really does determine how much blood the heart can pump with each stroke. And that's going to be an important determinant of how much energy the muscles get. So heart size is important. The second is what we call heart rate reserve. And that's simply the difference between an athlete's peak effort heart rate, so the highest heart rate they can get, and where they rest. And what's characteristic of most elite level endurance athletes is they have an incredible heart rate reserve. They can typically get up into the 200, 210 range at peak exercise, and they rest in the 30s, sometimes as high as the low 20s. So their delta across that peak to low is incredibly high. It gives them lots of reserve. It gets more complicated when we talk about the question of how we apply that within groups of elite level athletes. And unfortunately, nothing has really been shown to be predictive of who's going to be a stage winner versus who's going to be a Peloton rider. The heart is probably not the most important determinant of who wins the race, but I would say the heart is among the most important determinants of who's got the capacity to actually get on to one of these high level teams.
Yeah, it's, there's the saying that is often repeated during the Tour de France on the coverage, you know, this is not where you win the race, but you could lose it here. And I feel like this kind of falls into that category. Like it's necessary to get to this point, but it's not sufficient. It's necessary to win, but it's not sufficient to win, to meet certain cardiac metrics. And the difficult thing with performance is I can't think of anything that is solely sufficient. You know, even when you look at, VO2 and lactate measures and really, really nail down into the finer points of fitness, then you leave the psychology aspect out, and that's huge. So it's, you can't be that reductive, but it's interesting to see how certain aspects of cardiac physiology are certainly necessary to get to this point.
Yeah. I kind of think of the cardiac piece as being the gatekeeper, right? As you said, you simply can't get to the level of even being considered to participate in a race like the Tour de France unless your cardiac physiology is in the top 0.001% of the elite. But within that group, it probably does boil down to what happens above the neck more than anything. And that is the mental psychology, the preparation, the self-esteem, the mental stamina that goes into performing. And I think that's probably the unlocked frontier of performance physiology that we have yet to really fully understand.
So some great takeaways from Dr. Baggish there about why I'm not racing the Tour de France. And it makes me feel really validated in my my lack of ability to get on a world tour team.
You don't have a big heart. That's what it comes down to. No, it's really interesting to think about this very specific physiologic characteristics that are necessary to even be considered for a team, right? And I think one of the things that has really impressed upon me over the years is we've seen a lot of good recreational riders. And I've ridden with a lot of folks through the years who are strong riders, and some will even make comments on how, you know, they could hang in the Peloton if they could train a bit more and whatever. And what you realize is that no, there's no way they could unless they wanted, the Peloton wanted you there for some reason. These guys, it's such a selection of riders when you get to this point that it is just the best of the best. And they are physiologically gifted for sure. And then have spent a ton of time training this, right? So it's really the compounding of those two things, picking the right parents and training, spending your hours in the appropriate manner. And without that or those boxes ticked, you really can't even go on to have the conversation about whether or not you could be in the Tour de France.
Yeah, that was a fun conversation I remember having a few years ago about like how long could you hang in the Peloton. And I think I came down to if the break had gone, everybody had decided to sit up, it was time that nature breaks were being called, that I could probably hang until a team decided, okay, we're going to take, you know, maybe like 5-10 minutes while everybody's, you know, just kind of being nice.
Yeah, while they let the break go.
While they let the break go, then I'm dropped once everybody's done taking their nature break and it's like, okay, we're riding again.
Yeah. Yeah, it's insane the difference between a Tour de France peloton and your typical Tuesday night ride.
Yeah. Saturday night group.
Yeah. I pose this question also to JV, who's spent years actually making the choice of who gets hired, who goes to the tour, and cobbling together a team. And so let's hear what he had to say about it. In taking that broader view, I'm curious, when you're looking at putting together a team, both in the off season and pre Tour de France, but like assembling, you know, signing riders and then assembling a tour team, what are some of the things that you look for that is going to make a standout GC rider? And what are the things that you're going to look for in kind of a really capable domestique from a physiologic standpoint?
Well, the GC rider is, I mean, that's obviously, that's the $1 million question, right? But
I think it's more than a million.
Yeah, it is actually nowadays. It's multi-million dollar question. Exactly. You know, the simple answer that I was always told, you know, when I first started racing was, well, you know, if you can climb well and you can time trial well, then you can race GC. And I think that simplistic view actually kind of does still permeate into your casual fan base in cycling. You know, they think, oh, you know, he took this much time in the time trial, and then when the mountains hit, he, you know, it's not that simple at all. You know, for instance, you know, you have riders that can both time trial and climb, but they don't have the hand-eye coordination, the balance skills, the bike handling skills, you know, which by the way is another form of talent. It's like, yeah, people say, oh, well, you can develop those. Well, sure. I mean, okay, you can develop your VO2 max too, but it's not, you know, there are genetic ceilings. I mean, I personally will never be a world champion video gamer. It will never happen. I'm very bad at that. So there's just a ceiling to these things. And so especially in the Tour de France, you have to be really good in the peloton because there's a lot of crashes. It's incredibly dangerous. And the Tour de France is the one race of the year where nobody uses their brakes. So you have to be very, very skilled. So, you know, before we start getting into, you know, what the VO2 max is or what the lactate threshold is or what the, I don't know, you know, your 2 millimole threshold versus your 4 millimole or whatever, you know, you got to get into, you know, can they stay in the peloton for especially the first 10 days of the race? Then
if you crash all the time, then it doesn't matter.
Exactly.
Laying on the ground.
Yeah, exactly. And there are tons of riders like that, that, I mean, like from what I've seen so far, you know, Jay Vine, if you look at him, he's probably potentially the most physiologically talented rider in the entire peloton, from just a pure power output standpoint. But it seems like every Grand Tour he does, I mean, he always hits the deck. So, you know,
Is that unique? Is that unique? Not unique. Is that a problem that American riders, Australian riders, you know, non-European riders
for
face
sure
more than
others? I mean, we grow up, our races are on wider roads when we're kids. The pelotons are much smaller when we're kids. So your wide road, small peloton, even the bigger races in the US, you know, like the old Tour of California, the old Tour of Utah, wide roads, small pelotons. So premium isn't on bike handling. I mean, even if you watch, you know, criteriums in the US, it's like sort of a templated bike handling, meaning, you know, it's like always a 90 degree corner or close thereof. And the, you know, the peloton is basically strung out lap one. So it's sort of like, you're not like constantly having to fight you know what I mean? I remember when I came back from Europe, like I, you know, raced in Europe for years. I started out American bikers in my first 3-4 years in Europe, I sucked at riding in the peloton, horrible at it. Eventually worked my way up from sucked to mediocre. Then came back to the US, did my final year of racing in the US. And I mean, I remember I got second place in a pro nighttime criterium. I mean, like, what is that even? You know, like, and people are like, how did you do that? When did you become a sprinter? And I'm like, man, you don't get it. Like, I'm not a sprinter at all. It's just that the level of bike handling is so much higher in Europe that, of course, I could just ride in the front of the peloton in the dark. And on the last lap, I just sort of like made sure I never dropped out of like the top three places. And then, you know, of course, somebody sprinted around me. But so that's, you know, so it is for Australian and US riders. It's a way bigger challenge. And in, you know, Belgium or the Netherlands, they grow up on little tiny roads, huge pelotons, smashing into each other, fighting for, you know, position on every single corner. They're just, it's like, it's natural to them. I mean, it's the same as, you know, if you've ever been to Naples, which I would say Naples is the craziest driving in the world. And, you know, people in Naples, when they drive their cars, it's like totally normal to like cut people off and like cram your car into like this little spot and like jump a curb. And, you know, and when American drivers try,
you're talking about Italy. You're talking about Italy.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Napoli, Florida. Too. Yeah. When not Naples, Florida.
I think it works either way.
But like when American drivers like try to rent a car in Naples, I mean, it's funny. I've just seen it a number of times, and it's just, they're just like, they eventually sort of get like frozen in a roundabout and just sit there for like 10 minutes, you know, and unable to exit the roundabout.
Yeah. Clark Griswold style.
But okay. So then, sorry, that was an overly long explanation, but then we get into, there are pretty much any pro bike racer can train themselves up to the point that they can recover for a week of racing, maybe even 10 days. But 3 weeks, that again, that's a whole genetic different ball of wax. And we can't test that in the laboratory. I mean, I know I keep asking you, like, how can we test this? Like, what do we do to like determine?
Yeah, we try.
Exactly. The only way you test it is put someone in a 3 week stage race. And then you see if they fall apart at stage 15, you're like, okay. But to me, that's what I'm actually most curious about. What are the markers that determine somebody that can actually recover for 3 weeks? Because I was a rider who could not. I was good for a week, maybe 10 days at the outermost, but like that was it. I mean, I went from, you know, in my career, I went from sort of for a week, I could be one of the best climbers in the world by stage 14 or something of a 3 week tour. I was gruppetto with the sprinters. Like I was just empty. I was not resynthesizing glycogen again. I mean, you know all the symptoms, right? My body fat was actually going up where my muscle mass was coming down because I was just chewing up muscle tissue. And like, it didn't matter how much carbohydrate I ate because like, basically like it was just all it was doing is, you know, I was probably peeing it out. I don't know, but it wasn't actually synthesizing into glycogen into my muscle tissue because my muscle tissue was just so damaged. It wasn't happening anymore. Whereas, conversely, you know, my best example is our old rider Hegdal, who never won a week-long stage race in his life. Nobody would have described him as an exemplary time trialist or an exemplary climber, but he had an unbelievable. And by the way, he couldn't really ride in the peloton either. It's like, you know, like everything I just said. Like, well, he's supposed to be a good time trialist. Nope. Great climber, like riding the peloton, absolutely not.
Always last wheel, position in the peloton. Always.
But his capacity recovery was unbelievable, and basically in a 3 week tour, he would just get. It was like he was training. It was like he was getting better every day. Like the, you know, the whatever 16 hours between the finish of one stage and the start of the next stage for him was like most people taking like 2 days off. I mean, and he just built and built and built and built. And so then you get to the final week of the Giro that he won. And that was the best he's ever ridden in his entire life. And like, what you mean better than even when he was fresh for a 1 day race? Absolutely. The highest numbers we ever saw at a rider were at the end of a 3 week stage race, which, you know, what is that? I mean,
well, and you could see it like in, I mean, I remember being at races with him where, and I could think of a few other guys like this, but not many where, you know, week two and three, you come to the breakfast table and most of the guys are just dragging to get there. Right. And they're kind of sitting there head. I mean, they just look tired and understandably so. And then, you know, Ryder comes down, he's got more energy. He's kind of bouncing around, joking. He's kind of a quiet guy, but like compared to the first couple of days, you can tell he's feeling better. And so that resilience, when you can find someone with that resilience, it's really a game changer, but the trick is finding it.
Yeah. And it's why, you know, junior world champions don't necessarily ever turn out to be great professional riders is just that, like that, just because you're good at a, you know, 1 day race as a junior does not mean even a week long race does not mean that eventually you'll be, you know, good at 3 weeks. So it's tricky. I mean, it's you have to have all of those things, and the guys that do have all of those things, you know, Pogacar, the obvious example, who's the, sort of the most natural of all of them, great bike handler, recovers incredibly well for 3 weeks, probably actually gets stronger as the 3 weeks goes on. Obviously climbs incredibly well, time trials well, you know, it's like, where's the weak spot? There's really not one, right? Like Vingegaard's a little more interesting in that, like, he's become that over time. Like there's still, you know, you can see like bike handling was like a huge problem for him early in his career, but he's slowly but surely overcome that. And, you know, he's a more interesting one that, like, it the pieces didn't necessarily just fall in place for him, that he actually was able to attain that over time as opposed to just fall right into it. So, you know, obviously with us being a little bit smaller team, having to look for sort of the best rider we can get that fills as many of those slots as possible. I mean, if you look at Carapaz, you know, he sort of like fits, you know, he's getting there this year. It's taking him a while, but like, you know, he sort of fits like 4 out of the 5. Right. And I mean, great bike handler, incredible recovery, one of the best climbers on his day, great tactician, you know, all that's covered. Great time trialist. Ooh boy. That's a tricky one. Right. So, and you can see it. Carapaz, if you put him in a laboratory, or just did his pure, you know, 20-minute FTP, it's pretty good. You know, like for the guy who is the defending Olympic gold medalist, who's won the Giro d'Italia, finished podium in the Tour de France, you know, King of the Mountains jersey in the Vuelta, stage wins and, you know, all the Grand Tours. But like, you know, put him in an FTP test, it's like, I don't know. I mean, it's quite a few guys that would probably send me resumes immediately if they knew what his FTP results were, because they'd be like, "Ah, well, I can beat the Olympic gold medalist. I'm that good."
Yeah, but we've seen it. I mean, through you more than me, but certainly through the 14 years I've been with the team, we've seen guys who, on paper, should win everything and win. Maybe nothing, right? Yeah. Because there's just more to it than that. I mean, the races aren't won in the lab. And so these guys have to have the resilience, they have to have the bike handling, they have to have the psychological component, which is really just unquantifiable until you get them out there. Which probably drives you crazy, makes it fun.
Yeah. Right? No, I mean, it's just very, very, it's the art of multidimensional. One thing, heck, we haven't even discussed this, but this is something that you will see with not all, but most of your, you know, multi-time Tour de France winners, is they're actually quite aerodynamic on the bike. They're very low drag. And I'm not talking just the time trial bike. You know, sure, great, very refined time trial. I'm talking about on the road bike. You know, if you look at even old pictures of Greg LeMond and Bernard Hinault, right? Greg LeMond and Bernard Hinault, like, very long femurs, which allows them to fold their hips lower, you know, to get their torso lower, because the knee isn't coming up as much into the chest. So they've got a long femur and a short tibia, so the knee's not coming up as far. Narrow shoulders, wide hips, you know. So, I mean, I know that doesn't sound all that attractive, but, like, you know, they're not trying to be bodybuilders. It's not a beauty competition, right? Yeah. You've got these wider hips, you know, to support all the muscle mass in the booty where you're developing the power, and narrow shoulders to keep the surface area down. I mean, it's really interesting. Like, if you look, like, most of the great Jacques Anquetil, now we're going really far back, super aerodynamic rider on the road bike. So if you look at most of your really, you know, guys who've won Tour de France over and over again, they're actually quite aerodynamic on the road bike. Of course, there are exceptions to that, but it is an interesting feature that I think that, you know, you don't test that in a laboratory. But maybe we should.
And having known you for a while, I just want to clarify something. This is not a surgical problem that we can fix, right? There's nothing we can do with titanium and rods and stuff.
I know. I keep asking Kevin, I'm like, well, what if we just took off like a couple inches here and a couple inches there? And he's like, I don't know. I think that's against the spirit of the rules, JV.
So hearing from JV there, it really brings to point that it's not all just fitness physiology, and some of it comes down to bike handling, with this comment on nobody using brakes. And then, unfortunately, for the years of watching the Tour, it does seem like some riders just like to be on the ground.
Yeah. I mean, it's an unfortunate truth that you have to just get through that first week. There's going to be a bunch of crashes in the first week. And part of it's attrition. Part of winning is attrition. And I think he's really saying a lot of the same things that Aaron said, Bagish, that you have to meet a certain level of physiologic ability, so to speak, fitness and ability. But that only gets you consideration for the team, right? And then at that point, you have to have certain skills, certain psychology, an ability to prepare for the race, a resilience, the ability to stay upright so that you're there at the end of the race. And all those things are hugely important. And there are sports science inputs to these things. You know, whether it's psychology or resilience as it relates to kind of musculoskeletal or biomechanical factors. You know, there's things that we can both measure and influence. So I'm not saying that they're just like soft sciences, but I think everybody thinks about the Tour de France being the fittest people doing it. And while that is true, that's not sufficient to make the team, let alone be successful.
Yeah. And I think that's what makes watching it so much fun. You know, when power meters first came out, I thought, oh, this is going to ruin cycling. It's all just going to be numbers with heart rate monitors. It was the same thing with whatever it might've been. But in reality, that's not what is dictating, you know, so-and-so can do 6 point whatever watts per kilograms and he can do 5.9, but it's when you do those watts and it's how you apply that and when you do those attacks and if you are healthy and can do that and you haven't crashed earlier and those sorts of things. So it's such a fun race to watch, and it's a unique puzzle for you all to work with because you can do everything that we've talked about today and have the perfect preparation to it. And then as you've experienced, a team time trial goes out and everyone crashes on day one.
Man, team time trial just makes me like my skin crawl. Cause there was a period, the mid 2010s. So I'm going to guess like 2014, 15, 16. I could be wrong, but it was more or less that where there were three grand tours I went to in a row and all three of them had team time trials and all three of them, our guys went down. And it was just, I mean, it's a mass casualty event at that point. So yeah, I mean, you've got to be able to survive those types of competitions to be there in Paris. But before Paris, we've got the start, the grand depart. And this year it's in Bilbao, which is actually the Basque Country is one of my favorite places on the planet. And the days before the tour starts, I think, are really interesting as well. We talked a bit about camp and preparation and picking the team, but there's kind of these 3 or 4 days before the tour starts where there's a ton of energy, both within the team and outside the team. It's a really unique environment. It's kind of like before the Super Bowl.
Yeah. When will the riders get to Bilbao?
They'll get there about 4 or 5 days before. So if the race starts on a Saturday, they'll usually get there on the Wednesday, occasionally on the Tuesday. There's some specifics with like when the rest day is and certain things happen. Typically Tuesday, Wednesday, usually on the Thursday is a health control. So they come around and they do blood tests on all the riders and you have to be there by then. That test is, I mean, it's a thinly veiled doping test. They probably do test it, but they're also looking to make sure everybody is quote unquote healthy to do the race. There's a medical conference or a scientific conference that happens at the same time. It's not necessarily part of the tour. It's a separate organization that puts it on, but being a team doctor there, it's something that I've frequently tried to attend. It doesn't always work out with scheduling and whatnot, but I'd say one out of every 2 years, I've been able to attend part of the conference, and it's typically a pretty good conference. And then there's a meeting of the UCI's head doctor holds a meeting of all team doctors. And it's kind of the one big meeting of medical staffs for the year. So there's some general business that's attended to, but it's also where the tour's head doctor comes and kind of gives the layout for the medical program for the tour. You know, how you get in touch with her, how you get in touch with other doctors on the tour, their medical staff, how you get access to their imaging center, like everything you'd need to know. And so those first few days ahead of the tour are packed with things to be done. And the trick is for the staff to do all of these things while coming across as really cool and calm as the riders, just kind of, because we don't want to build more anxiety and anticipation in them. So there's a lot going on in the background. And then you get back to the hotel and you try to just make sure that everything is smooth and just kind of easy for the riders.
Yeah, it sounds like a really unique style experience in those days leading up to it. I think it's interesting there you talked about the team doctor, and the logistics of moving the tour every day is like you said, like, oh, it's like the Super Bowl prep, but it's like having that every day in a different location. So you have all of the team buses, you have the imaging bus that travels, all the medical thing, like all of this moves every day and sometimes has long, long transfers. And it's just miraculous that it's able to go and typically go as smoothly as it does.
Yeah. It's far from carbon neutral for a sport that's built on a machine that doesn't emit. But it's definitely a traveling circus. And even just within the team, you know, every afternoon there's one director who is charged with putting together the planning for the next day. I mean, for the whole thing. But so in the afternoon, you get the next day's planning, which will say when dinner is that night, if there's any meetings, when they're to occur, when breakfast is, when, you know, anything that happens between breakfast and departure is, when the bus rolls out, everything, you know, when the start is, when the warm up is, it'll tell you how long the neutral is to start. Like it's everything logistical. And if it says the bus rolls out at, you know, 10:15 a.m., the bus is leaving at 10:15 a.m., whether you're on it or not. And there have been staff members that get left at hotels in rural France and have to figure out how to get themselves either to the race, or if they can't do that, you know, to the next hotel. Fortunately, in all my years, I never got left. I'm kind of shocked I didn't. I mean, I'm pretty good with timing, but with that many race days, God, I'm trying to do the math real quick, but we're talking probably between 600 and 800 race days, 600 and 800 race days. I never got left. I came really close a couple times, but it's just like this traveling circus. And what you want to do in the days before the race is just make sure that even though all that is going on, it's just smooth and calm, because there's plenty of reasons for anxiety and just nervous energy. And the more we can get rid of reasons for that, the better. So those pre-tour race days are really interesting. And there are staff members who don't like it and prefer not to do the tour because it's just the stress that goes with it. It's a special time.
Yeah. Well, I can't wait to watch how the race unfolds this year, see how things go. I know, you know, the first national championship that you missed here, the EF rider got the win. So you not being at the tour, maybe this is a good omen for the team. We can stay positive.
Yeah, I'm okay with that. Like that, if that's the thing that pushes us across the finish line first, I'm glad to do it.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to racing. We'll have our picks sealed up and hidden somewhere when it gets a little bit closer to the actual race start. And then we'll be doing our first release on rest day one, correct?
That's correct. Yeah. So we'll get through that first, I don't know, week and a day or something like that. And then we'll come back to you on the rest day and talk about some specifics to rest days, like what happens on the rest day, but also talk about maybe some of the goings on in the race up to that point. Not so much from a race recap standpoint, but talk about the physiology of what occurs. You know, unfortunately, we'll probably be talking about some injuries or illnesses and how that's affected the race. So, yeah, we should have some good topics.
Yeah. Really looking forward to talking more on rest day one. And I appreciate you all tuning into this episode of Le Podium.
Thanks for listening to The Podium. To hear more, be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Instagram, where I am at Dr. Kevin Sprouse. That's Dr. Kevin Sprouse. The podcast posts at the_podium_podcast. You can also find and follow me on Strava. The content of this podcast is meant for general informational and educational purposes only and does not constitute medical advice. No doctor-patient relationship is formed. All listeners should speak with their doctor or medical practitioner before implementing any change in their healthcare regimen.
If you're currently a patient at Podium, then you have an established doctor-patient relationship with me, and I'm happy to discuss this with you. If you're not currently a patient at Podium, nothing in this recording establishes a doctor-patient relationship between us, nor does it constitute the practice of medicine nor the dissemination of medical advice. Should you implement any information contained herein without consulting your own physician, you do so at your own risk.
The Podium Podcast is part of the Palm Tree Podco network of podcasts. The show is produced and edited by Anthony Palmer. The content for this show is provided by the team at the Podium.